Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest and greatest episode of Inside the Hexagon. I am your host, as always, Phil Lanides, and joining me this week is my co-host, Josh Molina, a post-Christmas Josh Molina. Josh, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great, Phil, but it's really not post-Christmas because Christmas does not come until I get to do a podcast with you. So today, it has arrived.
So this is my gift to you, so congratulations.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
As we record this, it is actually Monday, December 27th, so we are technically post-Christmas, and we're late on this too, and I'm sure all you listeners will forgive us because Christmas, and we both have kids and had a lot of stuff going on this last weekend, but we said we would get an episode up on Monday, so here you go. We won't take up too much of your time, but we thought it'd be fun to kind of do a Strike Force version of the 12 days of Christmas. No, we are not going to sing this to you, but we are going to go through 12 gifts that we feel like Strike Force gave us during its run. So without further ado, Josh, if you're ready, let's go ahead and jump in.
I'm ready. As far as I'm concerned, there's like 100 Strike Force gifts.
Yeah, there you go.
We'll whittle them down to 12 for the audience.
There you go. Yeah, we had to work really hard to do this. But and I will mention, this is somewhat in order. It's not a perfect order for sure. But yeah, let's have some fun with this. So number one, on the first day of Christmas, Strike Force gave us Frank Shamrock's career resurgence. So just so everybody knows, you got to remember, Frank Shamrock was a true pioneer of MMA. He was one of the first guys, along with guys like Don Fry, to combine more than one discipline. And Frank really took it to another level. I mean, he had the submission wrestling, of course. He began to really work on his striking. He obviously, his cardio was amazing. Frank was the first first UFC light heavyweight champion, although really it was more of a middleweight title. But he had an amazing career in the UFC, and then he abruptly walked away from the sport, and then he decided to come back when Scott Coker and Strikeforce came calling. So we're going to say that was one of the first gifts. And Frank's, it's interesting that he's so tied to the beginning of Strikeforce. He only fought four times with the promotion, but let's quickly run down these. Shamrock versus Gracie. And of course, this was the largest live attendance in US MMA history at the time, sold out the Shark Tank in San Jose, California, and drew over 18,000 fans. It was the first and most attended. This is kind of a sad note, actually, but it was the highest attendance Strikeforce ever got, was their first event. So in a way, it was all downhill from there.
I think you kind of have to be in the Bay Area to understand how big this event was. It didn't get national attention, but in the Bay Area, it was huge. It was regional, but you can't get any bigger when it comes to regional promotion of an MMA card. It sold out the Shark Tank, and that was just a huge deal. And yeah, it was downhill from there. I don't think because things were not as good, but it was just because it was just, those two names, right? And it was just the first time they had promoted it. But yeah, that was great. It was just this incredible live moment. And for years, they were able to say, even while the UFC was getting big, hey, nobody's attended more people have attended our Strikeforce shows than your UFC shows at one time in history. So they were able to say that for a long time.
Yeah, I think they held the record for 5 years. So pretty amazing. The Shamrock versus Baroni fight didn't sell quite as well. I believe the attendance was around 11,000, but that is still one of my favorite fights in Strikeforce history for sure. The build, the feud, and then just the performance of both men in the cage, but especially, of course, Frank, because he won that. And that was just an amazing, amazing fight. Shamrock versus Kung Lee, which was seen as kind of a passing of the torch in terms of San Jose, because you had two San Jose guys fighting each other, and Kung Lee broke his arm. And that was, of course, an amazing fight as well. Love that fight. Even though Frank, who I consider to be something of a friend, was the one that went down in defeat there, but an amazing fight that really established Kung Lee as like the next standard bearer for the promotion. Unfortunately, due to his movie career and just kind of inactivity, it probably didn't take off the way that Scott Coker would have liked, but still, amazing. And then of course the Shamrock versus Diaz fight, which ended up being Frank Shamrock's swan song in MMA and Strikeforce. But just another really gritty performance by Frank. Diaz was just way too much, way too young, way too skilled. And again, an amazing fight. And again, something of a passing of the torch, so to speak, with Diaz, who did go. He was, and we'll talk a little bit more about Nick in a little bit. But Yeah, you got to say Frank really proved just how important of a figure he was in MMA, and that was, you know, we can give a lot of credit to Scott Coker and of course Strikeforce, but of course Frank. So that's the first gift. Yeah, go ahead.
Let me add a couple things here, and to me, and you can disagree with me here, but to me at this time, Ken Shamrock was the more well-known Shamrock of the two. And, you know, he had this career in UFC. He was in the WWE. And, of course, Frank did too, but he wasn't as popular. So, for me, to see Frank Shamrock in the Strikeforce was like, wow, there's, like, this other Shamrock who's actually really good announcer too, you know, and he's a really good fighter. So I think it exposed people to who Frank Shamrock was, and it wasn't just like the other Shamrock brother. Do you recall that period where Ken Shamrock was like the Shamrock guy, or were they always equal? 100%.
Yeah, 100%. And just to clarify, you mentioned Frank was in that too. You were talking about the UFC, not correct, WWF or WWE, because Frank was never there. But yeah. I mean, you have Ken, who sticks with the UFC for a while, and then Frank actually kind of rose up when Ken was in WWE, and then essentially when Ken came back, Frank was gone again, and Frank was out of it for, I think he had one fight maybe over the course of 5 years, and Ken at that point, now you're like, you can give credit to Ken, of course, along with Dana and the Fertitta brothers, but Ken and Tito, their trilogy of fights, especially the first one, were so important to the UFC. And then when they both coached, I think it was season 3, which is my favorite season of The Ultimate Fighter, when they coached, I mean, that took it to another level, even though the fight itself wasn't all that great. But Ken was a huge, huge name, a household name at that point for sure, while Frank, again, had kind of just, I don't know exactly what he was doing, but he wasn't competing. And so, yeah, he was, you know, Ken was definitely the bigger Shamrock, and to this day, I mean, you can make a case that Ken's the bigger Shamrock because of just his notoriety within the UFC. I mean, you know, Frank again left in whatever 2000, 2001, whatever that was, and has never been back. And, you know, meanwhile, you know, Ken has gone back. Ken's fought in Bellator, you know, that sort of thing. So I think Ken's still ultimately the bigger Shamrock, even if Frank is the better fighter and the better businessman and that sort of thing. But yeah, there, I absolutely agree with you 100%.
Now you mentioned Frank Shamrock has never been in the WWE, and that is true. But do you know the history of when Mickey Rourke shot his angle with Chris Jericho? Do you know what Mickey Rourke did? Do you remember this? He brought Frank Shamrock, and I think it was Nick Diaz, or it might have been Nate, because he was concerned Jericho was going to try to shoot on him. In the fight.
Oh, yeah,
you need to look this up. This is crazy Mickey Rourke stuff. He was concerned Jericho was going to try to swerve him and shoot on him, so he bought Frank with him. So Frank was in the audience, so Frank could jump the rail and take out Jericho. Look it up. It is a crazy story that is true. So, Frank never got into WWE because Vince McMahon probably would have looked at him and put him on NXT or something. But because you know, he wasn't 7 foot tall. But that is a true story.
I'm just Googling this, and yeah, I'm seeing Mickey brought Shamrock to WrestleMania in case things went south with Jericho. So that's wow. That's kind of crazy. Okay. I've never heard that before. Wow.
See that? I do bring value to this show.
No, that's good insight. That's good stuff. All right, well, let's move on. On the second day of Christmas, Strikeforce gave to me the introduction of Kung Lee. And that rhymed. Look at that.
Wow.
You know, again, we mentioned that that Shamrock kind of passed the torch to Kung Lee. And Kung Lee, being a Sanshao kickboxing star in the San Jose area, he was a big deal. I knew who he was before he started with Strikeforce. He fought on the final Strikeforce kickboxing card, which I was there in person. And so to see him, you know, the rise to stardom, and they did a really good job building him up, giving him guys that had credibility, but definitely guys that he could beat, and he did. And then by the time he got to Frank, he was ready to go, and that was pretty awesome. So yeah, you got to definitely sing Kung. You know, he did get his run in the UFC, and I would have liked to have had that have been more than it was. But as we've discussed, Kung kind of came along probably 10 years too late. In MMA, if he had been able to do it when he was 25 rather than 35, probably would have had a longer career. He only had 12 MMA fights, but still, he made an impact. And for a while there, he was a really big deal within MMA.
Yeah, it's too bad Kung did not start earlier. If you ever had the opportunity to see him throw his kicks live, like in person, you're just like, how would anybody survive getting hit by that. And obviously, when he did hit people with those kicks, he usually won his fights. So, just so unique. Frank Shamrock used to call him like a movie style fighter, because his kicks were like they were staged in Hollywood. It was almost like a fake martial arts film because they were so dramatic, but he did them for real. And so, I mean, that was really cool. I've interviewed Kung Lee several times, and the things that always strikes me about him is, you know, he's like, if you take Conor McGregor on one level, like, Kung's the opposite. Kung is like humble. Like, he's like a dude, if you met him, whether you're a billionaire or whether you got 10 bucks in your pocket, he's going to treat you the same. You know, he's like a really solid, humble, grounded dude. And I think that comes across in, you know, the interviews we've done with him on this show. Quick thing, you know, after Kung Lee, I just want to throw this in because I know you don't share the same affinity for this individual that I do. But, you know, we also saw Luke Rockhold, who was a product of AKA, and he was also a tremendous striker with his legs, you know, a great kicker. He's the same kind of guy who do these roundhouse kicks. And he wasn't quite as fast as Kung Lee. He wasn't quite as known for this as Kung Lee, because Luke was also a great grappler, and, you know, he'd submit people on the ground. But you know, we also saw, so we can thank Strikeforce for giving us Luke Rockhold, who, had he not been injury prone, who knows? He's still fighting today. He became a Strikeforce champion. He became a UFC champion. And, you know, he just looks the part, you know. And I can't believe he wasn't in the UFC from the beginning, because, you know, he's like a classic, you know, sort of, you know, a star that they could have made out of him. But I just wanted to, like, note the transition from Kung Lee to eventually Luke Rockhold.
I will allow it. All right, we want to move along quickly here. On the third day of Christmas, Strikeforce gave to me the Gilbert Melendez-Josh Thompson trilogy, perhaps the greatest trilogy in terms of in-cage action of all the famous trilogies out there, and I know that that's a high bar to set. I mean, obviously, within Strikeforce, it's the greatest trilogy. It might be the only trilogy in the history of Strikeforce, but regardless, even though it doesn't get the – it's not remembered as much as some of the other – you know, and we wouldn't call it a feud because they were always respectful and got along well. But as far as some of the other trilogies that we've seen in MMA history, it may not be the one that, you know, first comes to mind, but you can't beat those three fights in terms of in-cage action. I mean, just amazing, amazing 25-minute battles each time, and it was great to be able to experience that and see that. And we're not to their final fight in our, you know, in terms of chronologically speaking, where we're at in the podcast. So I'm looking forward to covering that third fight pretty soon here. All right. On the fourth day of Christmas, Strikeforce gave to me a national platform for Mauro Ranallo. So Mauro, of course, had been the Pride commentator. And so, you know, we thought, oh, we might see him go over to the UFC once the UFC bought Pride, and that never happened. Instead, Mauro was over with the Showtime guys, and so he was doing, I don't know if he was doing Glory Kickboxing at that time, but he was doing Showtime Boxing. But to see Mauro come back on a national stage here in the States, and I think that was his first time as far as being a, you know, nationally known commentator for MMA in the States, I mean, that was just awesome. And obviously, Josh, you and I are both huge fans of Mauro, and I'm really glad that Strikeforce basically helped introduce him to the American audience, because he, to me, he's the greatest MMA commentator of all time, and I'm glad that we got to see him progress from being kind of a color man when they brought in Gus Johnson, who was a bigger name, to being in his rightful place as the play-by-play guy. Yeah, thank you, Strikeforce. Thank you, Scott Coker, for Mauro Ranallo.
That should be number one on our list now
maybe,
that I think about it. No.
Maybe.
No, Mauro with his shaved head or with his nice hair,
either way,
whatever version works out great. But you know, he's like Al Michaels, he's like Jim Ross, Howard Cosell. I mean, he's the best of his sport, no doubt. And I mean, he's still a young dude, you know. I don't know, will we ever see him in the UFC? I mean,
I doubt it.
He should be. I mean, yeah. But you know, we could go on and on and on his calls. People can find him on YouTube, but he's this perfect combination of voice, charisma, personality with knowledge. And that's what makes him great.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right, let's continue. On the fifth day of Christmas, Strikeforce gave to me the greatest run of Nick Diaz's career. He went 6-0 in Strikeforce, undefeated, won the welterweight title. We'll quickly kind of set the stage here, but he had obviously been with the UFC. He went over to Pride, had that one of my favorite fights in MMA history, his bout with Takanori Gomi. Just an incredible, incredible fight. If you've never seen that, you should definitely check it out. Goes over to Elite XC, has a four-fight run there, and then he ends up going over to Strikeforce. And so his first fight was with Frank Shamrock. Talk about, you know, coming in and just going right after the king. But he comes in, faces Frank Shamrock, TKOs him, submits Scott Smith in another memorable fight, takes on Marius Soromskis and TKOs him pretty quickly. Then he fights Hayato Sakurai in Dream. Then he comes back to Strikeforce, gets revenge against KJ Nunes with a unanimous decision. That was his only fight in Strikeforce that went to a decision. Then he submits Cyborg Santos and then wraps up his run with the promotion with a TKO win over Paul Daly in one of the best one-round fights in Strikeforce history. So just an incredible, incredible run. And he you know, headlined a bunch of fights with the promotion. It was an extremely important part of it. So, I mean, four of his six Strikeforce fights were main events. And, you know, we talk about, oh, yeah, just a great fighter overall. Keep in mind, after he left Strikeforce, he's had five fights since 2011, and he's only won one of them. And so there's no doubt that his best run, as despite being so well known and the UFC giving him a platform to be so well known, you know, in his, no question about it, his best run was with Strikeforce. That's where he was most at home. That's where he was at his absolute best. So thank you, Scott Coker and Strikeforce, for giving us just the most memorable and best run of Nick Diaz's career.
And it's a sad reminder, actually, of how personality and trash talking and sort of having a dark side to you as a person that the UFC markets can make you a lot of money and have you a long career, give yourself a long career when you're actually not even competing at the top of your sport anymore. And we've seen this. We've seen it with Nick. We look at that with Conor McGregor in the last few years. So I guess it's good and bad. Personality, you're going to make some money, even if you're not winning a whole lot of fights. And we saw that during Nick Diaz's UFC run.
100%. All right, bringing us to halfway through on the sixth day of Christmas, Strikeforce gave to me Carano versus Cyborg, which was so important because it proved that women's MMA, when properly promoted and with the right athletes involved, was a viable entity within the sport of mixed martial arts. Drew a very, very strong crowd to the Shark Tank in San Jose, drew very well on Showtime. I mean, there's just, you know, it was huge that Gina Carano and Chris Cyborg were able to pull off what they were able to pull off. I mean, it just was an amazingly well-promoted event and just something that will, again, go down in history. Drew almost 14,000 fans to the HP Pavilion, to the Shark Tank. And again, in the main, it was the first time in MMA history that a women's fight had main evented a national card. Obviously, there had been women's fights before, and there had been events that had been headlined by women, but they were never a nationally promoted event like this. And those women were able to not only deliver in terms of, you know, promoting and you know, drawing and all of that, but also in terms of in cage action, they delivered, and it set the stage for the rise of Chris Cyborg and then the eventual emergence of Ronda Rousey, Miesha Tate, and some others as well. So it's such an important bout, and so we're grateful for that today.
Yeah, you said it perfectly. It is the birth of women's MMA in the United States. And if it wasn't for Scott Coker doing it, you know, we'd not look at today. We've got this incredible women's division in the UFC. So just amazing, just incredible. And I think this could be number one, too. You know, you could say that, hey, Strikeforce, you know, paved the way for women's mixed martial arts in America.
Yeah. All right, on the seventh day of Christmas, Strikeforce gave to me Fedor Coming to America. This is kind of this is one of those ones where you get the gift and at first it looks great, but then it falls apart. because unfortunately, Fedor's run with Strikeforce did not go how any of us wanted, how Scott Coker wanted, how Fedor wanted, how, you know, Fedor's fans wanted, but it was still a big deal. You know, coming off of Pride and not being able to strike a deal with Dana and the UFC, I mean, he needed a national promotion. It was great for him to make his promotional home with a United States promotion for a run there. And again, didn't go the way we wanted it to, but it was definitely a big deal.
You know, I just want to add something here. Fedor had this mystique about him for a lot of MMA fans, even though they had not seen him in the UFC. He was, you know, known for his incredible ability to fight guys who were bigger, rally, come from behind. He had this great career in Pride. You could find clips of him if you weren't, like, you know, already watching them live. But when he showed up in Strikeforce and it was promoted as this primetime card, this was like a big deal because finally mainstream America could see who's this Russian MMA fighter. Like, I keep hearing about this guy Fedor's pound for pound the best of all time, but he's not in the UFC, so I don't understand, like, what's the deal. And so here he is on national TV, and you know, he had fought for Affliction, he had done some pay-per-view things, not a lot of people saw those pay-per-views, but here he was on CBS, right? So everybody could, who's flipping channels, you know, so whether it's guys like you and I, Phil, or 70-year-olds who watch TV every Saturday night, you know, and could see him on, they got to see this, and it was just incredible. And I just want to note, when he knocked out Brett Rogers, I mean, that was one of the greatest Strikeforce memories, and as far as I'm concerned, because Brett had him hurt. Can you imagine if Brett Rogers would have knocked Fedor out in his debut? But Fedor rose from the ashes and just landed this incredible punch and then pummeled Brett. And honestly, it ended Brett Rogers because he was never the same after that either. Nope. And so Fedor got his moment, right? He got his moment in the U.S. on national TV. And it was, you know, it was like almost 5 million people, if you remember, who watched that show. I mean, that's a lot of people for that time for MMA. So, that was pretty cool. And who cares about what happened? We're never going to talk about Fabricio Verdum. No.
Well, we don't have to now. He's, as far as where we're at in the history of Strikeforce, Fabricio's done. So we don't have to talk about him anymore.
Good.
So, all right, moving on. On the eighth day of Christmas, Strikeforce gave to me the matchmaking talents and efforts of Scott Coker and Rich Chow. You know, look, at the end of the day, Strikeforce had a lot of fun fights. As you kind of like look through their history, reawakening the MMA audience to Shamrock versus Gracie, that famous feud, Tank Abbott, you know, we forget about that sometimes, but Tank Abbott had a cup of coffee in Strikeforce, took on the headhunter, Paul Buentello, one of my favorites. You know, Shamrock versus Baroni, just a pro wrestling style feud and the way that it was promoted. They did a one night middleweight tournament between, you know, four different competitors. Yeah, that's just fun stuff. You know, I mean, we unfortunately had to see Bob Sapp compete in the promotion, but you know, that was a little bit of a mistake, but that was a big name to bring in at that time. Putting together, matching together Josh Thompson and Gilbert Melendez, all the Shamrock fights, all the Diaz fights. We already talked about Carano versus Cyborg, bringing in Fedor. There's so much that they did that was just fun. You know, it was fun to watch these fights. It was fun to watch these events. And, of course, Josh, you and I are enjoying going through them. Yeah, you have some duds sometimes, like Overeem versus Verdun. You know, you have some stuff that doesn't go the way that you want it to go. But, you know, by and large, these are good fights. These are fun fights. So, again, I'm appreciative of the matchmaking that was given to us over the years. And then, speaking of, on the ninth day of Christmas, Strikeforce gave to me the heavyweight Grand Prix. It was, you know, a very unique thing to the States at that time. Dana's never really been big on tournaments. And I appreciate a good tournament. You know, it'd be nice to be able to see them go down in one night. Those are very difficult to pull off. There's injuries. There's all. It's very difficult to pull those off. So I understand why somebody like Dana wouldn't want to do those. But doing one over time, I think that's pretty cool. It's part of Bellator's model. I think it's a cool idea. I like it. I like the way that it's. You know, I like the way that they're laid out. And so I'd say that might be their greatest matchmaking or most innovative or unique matchmaking, thing that they did during Strikeforce. And I'm grateful for it. I think it was pretty cool.
You know, I'm still waiting for a tag team MMA on the mainstream. But I'll take the Grand Prix, right?
Yeah, I don't think you're going to see that anytime ever. So, at least in the States. You see those, like, videos sometimes of, like, you know, like Russia or, like, over in, you know, whatever. And they're, you know, five guys fighting each other at the same time. And, you know, guys are, like, coming over and punching the other guy in the face and then going back to, like, yeah, I just... That's not, to me, that's not MMA, and that's not something I'm interested in. So hopefully we never see that over here. But, yeah, I don't think any athletic commission in the States would ever approve something like that. So, yeah, I don't think it's something we'll have to worry about.
No, I agree with you. I'm just, you know, obviously joking over here. But, yeah, Grand Prix was unique and visionary, and we don't see enough of it here in the U.S., you know, those type of tournaments.
All right, moving on. We got just a few left here. On the 10th day of Christmas, Strikeforce gave to me Ronda Rousey. There's some more rhyming for you. But, hey, she went 4-0 in Strikeforce. I until we kind of dug into her a little bit recently, I hadn't realized just how much of a killer she was in the cage. I mean, just an incredible run in MMA overall. She had 12. She was 12-2. None of her fights ever went to a decision, 9 submissions, 3 knockouts in terms of her victories. When she started with Strikeforce, she was only 2-0. She submitted her first 8 opponents. I mean, and that includes her run in Strikeforce. She won by armbar with every single fight of her first 8 wins. And that's just, that's amazing. And it's not like she was fighting, you know, weaklings. I mean, Julia Budd is a tough competitor. Obviously, Misha Tate, one of the greats. Sarah Kaufman, the first Strikeforce women's bantamweight title, just walked right through her. You know, Liz Carmouche, when she gets over to the UFC, very tough competitor, takes on Misha Tate once again, beats her. Sarah McMahon, an Olympic, I think silver medalist, if I remember correctly. Alexis Davis, she knocks out in 16 seconds. Kat Zingano, she submits in 14 seconds. And then Beth Correa knocks her out in 34 seconds. And that was the end of her run as far as her wins, because she lost to Holly Holm and Amanda Nunez next in their last 2 fights. But obviously, just an incredible athlete, a great performer, and she essentially is the one that convinced Dana, not saying they sat down and talked about it at a table, but convinced Dana that women's MMA was viable. You got to look at Carano and Cyborg as like, hey, that's the one that really put it on the map. But Ronda is the one that convinced Dana, who had said he would never do women's MMA. He signs her. She becomes the first woman signed to the UFC as a fighter, brings her over, gives her the UFC bantamweight title. She promptly defends it successfully. As far as in the cage, like, there's really nothing negative you can say about Ronda Rousey other than her attitude, in my opinion. But yeah, Strikeforce gave her the platform, and again, Strikeforce made women's MMA possible on the stage that we see it, and Ronda was a big part of that.
Such a pro wrestling move to just hire her and give her a belt.
Give her the belt. Her the champion. Come on. Like, just hand her the big Triple H. Hand her the big gold belt. I mean, what a heel thing to do. But Ronda, you know, she approved it, you know, by going out and defending it successfully. So yeah, a bunch of times.
You know, in preparation for the show, because you know I do deep preparation for this, just like you, Phil. I went out and watched Ronda Rousey's championship victory over Misha Tate when she won the Strikeforce title in the bantamweight division. And wow, this is crazy. I don't know if you remember it. We haven't got there yet in our show, but she taps out Tate, and she just stands up and walks around. Like, there's no smile. There's no celebration. She's just like, okay, I won the fight. What's next? It's crazy. It's such a contrast to so many people who win titles and who just, like, you know, go, they jump on the top of the cage and, you know, they start yelling at people in the crowd. Like, she didn't celebrate at all. She just kind of just said, hey, I won. So I think it says a lot about her personality and just what a tiger, killer, lion she was, you know, at this time in her career.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, defended her women's bantamweight title 6 times in the UFC. I mean, just an amazing, amazing run. And you just, yeah, it's hard to, I mean, she, you know, there's people like, obviously Amanda Nunez, who's coming off a loss as we record this, but you know, she won the women's bantamweight title. She's a two title, you know, 2 belt holder. She beat Chris Cyborg. She defended both the featherweight and the bantamweight titles successfully. I mean, that's ridiculous. And then Cyborg, you know, Strikeforce title holder, Invicta title holder, UFC title holder, Bellator title. I mean, she wins the belt everywhere she goes. And so she's obviously amazing as well. But Ronda is right up there. And we've talked about the, you know, kind of the Mount Rushmore of women in terms of Strikeforce fighters. And, you know, obviously Ronda's, if not position number 1, you know, she's number 2, but might even be number 1. So pretty amazing. All right, we got a couple more here. On the 11th day of Christmas, Strikeforce gave to me just a bunch of crazy moments. I mean, just incredible amount of knockouts and come from behind stuff. So we'll quickly run down a few of these. But Robbie Lawler's one punch knockout of Melvin Manoff, if you don't remember that, in Miami, Melvin had just been just destroying Robbie Lawler with leg kicks. I mean, he was hurt from the leg kicks. I believe he landed 2 punches. One was to Melvin's dome on the feet, and then one was to him on the mat, and that was it. So Lawler only got off 2 strikes, but he made him count. One of the greatest just like I would say, call it a comeback. It wasn't really a comeback. It was just like a last ditch. Like my leg's going. I gotta hit this guy, and he did. Of course, the miracle in San Jose, Scott Smith coming back against Kung Lee, and that was a true comeback. Smith had been getting beat up for 2.5 rounds. He lands, Kung makes a mistake, Scott Smith takes advantage of it. We hear the very memorable call from Mauro Ranallo on commentary, and just an incredible Christmas present for Josh and all of Scott Smith's fans, of course. And then how about 40-year-old Dan Henderson, who, you know, probably thinking people are thinking he's past his prime. He knocks out Feijão to win the Strikeforce light heavyweight belt. I mean, that was incredible. Feijão much bigger. Hendo didn't have to cut weight to make 205. So for him to be able to do that at that age, where he was at, all the miles on his body, the Olympic wrestling, all the amateur wrestling, and then all the fights in the UFC, that was just an amazing moment as well. And then, of course, one of the most brutal uppercut knockouts you will ever see, Nate Marquardt knocking out Tyron Woodley to win the Strikeforce welterweight belt. Josh, you and I have talked about this a little bit offline before. That slow, you can find it on YouTube, there's a slow-mo version of the uppercut, and it is like watching some guy give another guy CTE with one punch. Like, it was just brutal, and one of the nastiest knockouts that you'll ever see. So
yeah, I mean that knockout, I remember being stunned because Tyron Woodley was rising, Nate was kind of past his prime, and it was just like, wow, what a punch. I've never seen an MMA knockout like that before, and to this day I think it made Tyron Woodley less of a fighter, because even though he went on to strike to UFC and won the title, he was always really cautious with the stand-up after this. And I know he knocked out Robbie Lawler and crazy lucky punch, but I think he made Tyron afraid of getting hit. And that's why we had these like horribly boring Stephen Thompson fights in the UFC with him. But that was a crazy knockout. And it showed me right away that Tyron, boy, you want to beat him, just hit him in the face. He did not like to get hit. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, and then finally wrapping things up, on the 12th day of Christmas, Strikeforce gave to me an alternative to the UFC. Man, more of these, I did not mean for any of these to rhyme. That was not on purpose, but this worked out well. But hey, you know, it might be the greatest gift of all that they gave us, was there was an alternative. There was another promotion that was doing things a bit differently that we could watch until they got bought by Zuffa. This was, you know, this was the underdog that we could root for. It was fun to watch. It was fun to be a part of that. Josh, you and I, of course, both worked for Strikeforce for a time as contractors. And so it was really cool. And I'm from the San Jose area. That I was born in Mountain View. I was raised in the Bay Area. I lived in San Jose for a while. So it was my hometown promotion. I was there for the last kickboxing event of Strikeforce. I was there for the first MMA event and then several events. I was there for Corano Cyborg. I was there when Fedor got tapped by somebody that we won't mention again. To me, it was such an important, and that's why we do the podcast. You know, that's why we're doing this podcast. And so I'm grateful for that. I'm thankful for that. It didn't go the way that I wanted it to, but in the same way that WCW pushed WWF during the Monday Night Wars to do better, to be better, to deliver more to the audience, I believe, and I don't say I believe it, it is a fact that Strikeforce drove Dana and the UFC to do more, to do women's MMA, to put on bigger fights, to spotlight, younger fighters, spotlight up and comers that, again, without the platform that Strikeforce provided them, maybe UFC would have given them an opportunity. I mean, obviously there's no way of knowing that, but it seems pretty clear that without Scott Coker and Strikeforce, that some of these fighters, both men and women, would have never gotten the opportunity they got. So I think we can all be grateful for Strikeforce in that sense as well.
Yeah, you know, back when people were watching UFC in bars on the big screens, you know, and it was like a scene to go out and watch UFC because UFC was like cool and the brand and it was like the hot thing. Strikeforce was an alternative for people like you and I who like didn't want to be like with the frat boys down at, you know, right, the bars watching these things.
The meatheads that just want to see guys get bloodied up and, you know, broken bones and have no idea what an omoplata is or, you know, why someone's transitioning and, you know, from guard or, you know, passing or whatever, that you and I would know enough, not that we're experts, but we would know enough to be able to enjoy that and not just be a bunch of meatheads that are drunk and want to see guys kill each other.
Hey, I know when the Undertaker's trying to put on a go-go Plata and he can't do it because he can't do it. I know how he needs to move his legs. I know that. Okay, no, but yeah, my point is those meatheads who just want to like look cool, there's Strikeforce was like an alternative for like those fans who like, hey, we like this sport. We like the fact that there's like these fighters here where the focus is on the fighters. It's not necessarily on three letters. And it's just this incredible opportunity to sort of identify with this underdog promotion. And they had this great promotion. You know, I'll never forget Frank Shamrock coming out against Kung Lee, and he's got the Strikeforce championship around his, you know, his waist. And then he's got the San Jose Sharks jersey, and he just strutted down. And this is not a UFC moment. This is a Frank Shamrock moment, you know? And that was just really cool, was just giving us a little bit of those alternative entrances that live on in Bellator today, quite frankly.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it kind of reminds me of AEW to WWE, that, you know, again, there's an alternative for the hardcores. There's an alternative for the people that, you know, aren't just there for the circus stuff or the, you know, whatever. And not that UFC has ever been big on like the circus fights. I mean, they've done some, you know, stuff like, obviously.
No, don't say it. Don't say it.
You're okay. The Randy Couture, okay. James Toney fight, you know, like stuff like that, like kind of the one-offs, you know, the CM Punk stuff. I know that's probably the one you didn't want me to say, but which I don't consider those to be circus fights because they didn't put them in with like, you know, George St. Pierre or something like that. You know,
right.
At least tried to put him at guys that might be at his level. But
hey,
anyways,
look at, Mickey Gall became the biggest star in the sport. What are you talking about?
Yeah, of course. All right. Well, good stuff. Josh, I appreciate you taking the time to do this. This was fun. We got some really cool events that are coming up that we're going to be covering. Next up is going to be Gilbert Melendez finally back in the cage defending the Strikeforce lightweight title against Jorge Masvidal. So that should be interesting. The controversial bout between Chris Cyborg defending her women's featherweight belt against Hiroko Yamanaka. Gegard Mousasi is back to take on OSP. And then a fun fight between KJ Nunes and Billy Evangelista. Looking forward to covering that should be a good one. Past that, King Mo has agreed to be on the podcast in January, so we're working on a date for that. So that should be a fun one. I'm looking forward to that, but that should be pretty cool. We got some other events coming, or some other events to cover coming up, but we're actually coming to the end of this podcast. We've got about, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, only 7 more events before we wrap things up. We'll have some different interviews in there as well. So we'll have some stuff. We got a couple more months at least, but yeah, we appreciate everybody coming on and supporting us. We really appreciate that. If you want to reach me, you can reach me at phil@insidethehexagon.com. Would love to hear from you, but we hope that you had a Merry Christmas. We hope that you have a Happy New Year, a safe and Happy New Year, that make sure that if you do drink, if you do party, that you take care of business and you make sure you got somebody to drive you or don't travel or whatever it is, but be safe. We want to see you come back in 2022. But again, we appreciate your time. So with that, we're going to go ahead and ride off into the sunset. Hope that you stay safe and you stay healthy, and we will see you soon.
Bruce Martin, host of Pit Pass Indy. Each week, I go behind the scenes of the NTT IndyCar Series and introduce our listeners to the biggest stars of IndyCar, which features the Indianapolis 500 as its cornerstone event. The men and women that compete in IndyCar may be the bravest athletes in all of sport, as danger lurks around every corner. They are able to look danger in the eye without flinching. That is why the NTT IndyCar Series features the best racing on the planet. Join me every week as we talk to the stars of IndyCar, including the legends of the Indianapolis 500, on Pit Pass Indy from Evergreen Podcast.